Water. We're nowhere without it. No life, no cities. It ain't cheap, but we keep wasting the stuff. Droughts seem to teach us little or nothing. We're draining the aquifers. Battles for water in this country bring down governments. And the delivery system, the climate, is shifting. To talk the future of water in 2026, we're joined by Stuart Kahn, Professor and Head of the School of Civil Engineering at Sydney University. Stuart, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
Now look, explain, please. Climate change. The air is warmer. It absorbs more moisture, therefore more rain. It's a good thing, is it not?
So in some places we are expecting that. We are expecting to have increased rainfall as a consequence of climate change for the reasons that you just described. Ultimately, we're expecting change. We're expecting the weather systems to change in the ways that water will move around the globe in different patterns. So some places will become wetter and some places will become drier. And there's still quite a bit of uncertainty about what's going to happen where. But the real issue, I think, that cities are going to have to deal with related to climate change is this increased frequency and severity of extreme weather events. So we might have an overall average increase or decrease in the amount of water, but if that average comes in extreme floods and extreme droughts, then it's very hard to deal with.
And cities can't chase the rain.
Cities can't change the rain. They get.
They can't follow it.
They get the climate that comes with their location.
Yeah, right. You have this fascinating notion of making ourselves as much as possible rainwater independent. Okay, now what does that mean? How do we do it? And are we trying?
Yes, I can't take full credit for that notion. That actually is a highlight of the current Greater Sydney Water Strategy. And so when we've looked at how we supply water for cities in the past, we have mostly looked at average water availability and made sure that average water availability pretty much matched average demand as that changed over time. But increasingly, through a few recent droughts that we've experienced on the east coast of Australia, the 2017 to 2020 drought, the millennium
which
drought.
Which was a historically dreadful drought.
A very intense drought. It was short. It was 3 years, but it was very intense. If you look at how rapidly our water storage has dropped from 2017 to the end of 2019, we've never seen anything like it. We lost 50% of our supply over a three-year period.
Our being
period.
Sydney. But this,
Sydney.
But yes. This drought was the whole of the eastern coast of the continent.
And even more, in 2019, most of Australia was in drought. And so that we have the drought effects, the climate effects on the east coast. But we also, Perth has had long-term drying of the climate, and much of southern Australia was very dry during that period too. And of course, that's the period that led into the Black Summer bushfires of 2019-2020. So the entire country, the southern half of the country, was very dry going into that tinderbox scenario that led to the catastrophic fires.
And don't forget the water element in the politics of the bushfires. Remember the man who didn't hold a hose?
We do remember the man who didn't hold a hose, and holding a hose was the most essential job, of course, which I think was probably the point he was trying to make. The less water that there is available, the more likely that we're going to have those fires, and the more difficult it becomes to access water to deal with those fires when they do happen.
Stuart, does Australia learn from droughts, or does Australia just say, oh, look, they come and go, it'll rain again and we'll be okay?
My observation is that Australians have short memories. So we get to the end of a drought like the millennium drought. We've learned a lot at the end of the millennium drought, and we learned a lot at the end of this more recent drought that finished around the end of 2019. There are experiences, there are good plans, there are proposals that are drawn up for how we will supply water to cities in different ways. In many cases, even the funding has been identified to build new infrastructure. But when the drought breaks, our priorities change. And especially if we're talking about spending billions of dollars, I think it's hard for politicians to have that conversation, to communicate with the public around the need to spend billions of dollars shoring up water supplies when the dams are full. They'd much rather be talking, and there are other priorities that need to be spoken about. We have a housing crisis. We have other competing demands for the money that needs to be spent. So It is a short memory. We do forget, but really it's because we've put it off because the urgency has gone away and we're going to wait for the next crisis. And when that next crisis comes back, we'll be back talking about drought again and
good
how
intentions,
we prepare for the next one.
No follow through.
Yeah, yeah. And we've seen that as a recurring pattern definitely over the last 20 years.
Do you think Australians underestimate just how much it costs to supply a city with water?
I think we do for a few reasons. I think there's evidence for that. So we know that the way that we're supplying water at the moment relies on a lot of infrastructure that is aging, that needs replacement, that needs that maintenance investment. We also need to invest in the new infrastructure for new housing scenarios. We saw when Sydney Water put together their pricing proposal that builds in the money that's needed to build that infrastructure.
Tell us about this pricing proposal, because I'm sure it's a familiar pattern across Australia.
So water prices in New South Wales are regulated by IPART, the Independent Pricing and Regulatory Tribunal. And what that means is that if an organisation like Sydney Water wants to invest money in infrastructure, and that money will need to come from customer bills, and so therefore there'll be an implication that customer bills will need to rise to provide the money, they need to make the case to the regulator, to IPART. And what we saw is Sydney Water making a strong case for the need to spend about $32 billion over the next 10 years.
By upping the bills by how much?
I don't recall the precise dollar.
It was about 50%, I think.
Right. Yeah. So not an insignificant increase in percentage terms, but I would argue that water is already underpriced. Water is a relatively cheap utility compared to what we pay for things like electricity and gas and other utilities. And what we saw when there was a proposal for prices to rise to pay for the infrastructure that was needed is, first of all, a response in the media, and it was all about bill shock. And this is how it's going to affect consumers, and it's outrage. We also saw the political response. The Premier wrote to IPART saying that we have a cost of living crisis, so it's very important to make sure that you do this job properly, that you have this legislative requirement to do and make sure that the expenditure is prudent and necessary. But the Premier's letter also said that if there are opportunities to delay investments in infrastructure to the next pricing proposal, if we can kick that can down the road for another 5 or 10 years, then we should do that. And I think that's a big mistake, because I think that is effectively putting off the costs for the infrastructure that we're using now and benefiting now, and ultimately pushing the necessary maintenance costs and renewal costs onto future generations so that they will pay for our drinking water supplies as part of their water costs and their water bills.
I know this may be outside your remit, but do you know of any big city in Australia that is now investing enough in water needs of the future?
I think we see different examples of how the big cities around Australia are managing this. We're all dealing with this problem in that we have expensive infrastructure that is needed, and expensive maintenance bills that really do need to be addressed at this point. So they're all faced with that challenge, and they're all faced with the fact that water is not an expensive resource. And so the ability to claw in that money that's needed through customer bills is quite limited compared to if you're selling coal seam gas.
It's not an expensive resource, or
For customers.
Oh, for customers.
So
yes.
when we're selling water for about $3 per kilolitre, $3 per 1,000 litres treated and delivered to your door, that's a pretty low price to pay.
What do you reckon we should be paying?
Well, if we looked at the true cost and we started to factor in all of the externalities associated with the infrastructure that we build and the maintenance fees that will be required to maintain those assets over the longer term, I wouldn't be surprised if water bills would double. So, I think we're at least getting the water at the tap for half price for what it ultimately should be for a sustainable system that actually leads to that reinvestment and renewal and protection of all of the external impacts.
Are any cities in Australia usefully recycling water? I mean, this damn stuff can be used again and again and again, Stuart.
Yes. And so I didn't finish answering your previous question, but the answer is where I was going is the same as the answer to this question. So I think Perth is a good example. If you look at the water utility that manages water in Western Australia, they're called Water Corporation, they recognised 20 years ago at least that there had been a step change in the environment, the amount of water that was available to that city. They recognised what some of the social and economic implications would be of not having sufficient water available. And in the early 2000s, they started heavily investing in resilient water supplies. And so seawater desalination has been a big one, and there are several seawater desalination plants operating in Western Australia now, and several more on the books being planned up and down the West Coast.
Solar powered?
How we have supplied energy to the desal plants has been an interesting point. None of the desal plants are directly solar powered. None of them have a solar panel sitting on top and delivering electrons through that solar panel. But all of the desal plants that were built in the 2000s all happened to have different, depending on which state you were in, but there were different planning approvals that were provided that mostly required them to offset their energy emissions. So if we look at Sydney, for example, the Sydney desalination plant purchased energy from a wind farm at Bungendore, the one on the way to Canberra, the one that Joe Hockey said was an eyesore.
Oh, the one along Lake George.
Down that way, yes.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah.
So different opinions on that. So the Sydney desalination plant, every kilowatt of power that they consume, they need to buy the same equivalent amount from the wind farm, which is then feeds that back into the grid. So they may not be using the electrons directly from the wind farm, but we assume that all electrons are created equally, and therefore that offset is meaningful. So yes, the desal plants are mostly powered by renewable energy in Australia, and I hope that's something that continues with further expansion.
On Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Stuart Kahn, Professor and Head of the School of Civil Engineering at the University of Sydney, about this nation's appetite for water. Stuart, is it cheaper, is it better, more sensible to clean up water you've already used or take the salt out of seawater?
Yep. So I still didn't get to answering the previous question then about where are we recycling water and doing that well. And that answer was also Perth. And Perth has shown that is a viable option. So
this
they're doing
is reuse,
both.
Cleaning yes. up and reuse.
So Perth have built major seawater desalination plants, and they've built a major purified water recycling scheme. They take water from the Beenyip wastewater treatment plant, which is in the northern suburbs of Perth, to the north of Perth. And they purify that water firstly through conventional sewage treatment processes, conventional wastewater treatment processes, and then further purify it through membranes, reverse osmosis, and UV disinfection before they then transfer that water back into their drinking water supply, which in Perth is a bit different to Sydney. Most of their drinking water supply comes from groundwater. They don't have a big Warragamba Dam.
Yeah.
So they're pumping that water back down into the aquifer to recharge the aquifer. It is generally, it's sometimes hard to generalise because all water supply schemes are different. They depend how far you're pumping water, different distances, etc. But to generalise, it is generally a lower energy process to purify wastewater than to purify seawater. And that's largely to do with the treatment process. The reverse osmosis process is a membrane process. The amount of energy that's required to push water through a reverse osmosis membrane is a function of the amount of salt that's in the water. Seawater is about 32 grams per litre salt. Wastewater is usually no more than about 1 gram per litre salt. So hugely different. And that means that you can push wastewater through a reverse osmosis membrane at lower energy than what you need to do the same for seawater. So that means you have lower costs because you have lower electricity costs, yep. and the power costs are the major cost at most at a seawater desalination plant, and you have a lower carbon footprint as well because you're using less energy.
Is Sydney uniquely wasteful with its water? I mean, I don't know what other cities are doing, but Sydney just pumps all its sewage out to sea.
Traditionally, that's how our big coastal cities and our small coastal cities have been designed.
Just pump it into the sea.
So if you have the ability to capture water in big dams, as we do in Sydney, there's a huge infrastructure cost in building those dams. But once they're constructed, the operational costs are relatively low. And it has been generally observed that it would cost more to recycle water than to continue to capture more and more water. So that one-way conveyor belt from the catchments through the city, through our toilets, to the wastewater treatment plant into the ocean, has been the way that most cities have been designed and operated. But as we start to reach the limits of how much water we can capture through our conventional drinking water catchments, and we start to better understand some of the other difficulties associated with relying on rainfall, that we become very drought prone, then we start to reevaluate and we start to realize, well, actually, yes, it does cost energy. Yes, it does cost money to take that water and treat it and purify it and potentially to move it to where it's needed is an expensive process, but that expense starts to look more and more favourable as our conventional water supplies become more and more limited. And of course, when cities are growing, when cities are developing, you build the easiest water supplies first. You build the ones that are going to cost the least to build and to operate. So every time you go out and you build a new supply, a new dam or pumping water from the Shoalhaven as we built in the 1970s, you're going further away and you're getting more expensive and more difficult. So eventually you do get to a point where recycling the water that you have becomes comparatively a favourable option. And then, of course, you have the environmental benefits of not just discharging all of that wastewater out into the ocean or other parts of the environment.
Yeah, yeah. Where are we in battles over water inland in Australia? I noticed that the Coorong and the Lower Murray have again been declared, what's the expression? They've been declared, in terrible danger. Is that going to change anybody's use of water in those rivers?
So we don't know exactly how that listing will impact the management of water.
But well, the minister has put out this statement that seems to say, look, if you're using water now, you can keep using it.
Yeah, so it won't affect licensing. It won't affect the current licensing and allocations, but it may well have implications for what other things can be done in the catchment, what sorts of developments might occur that might impact on water quality or water quantity or the movement of water around. It might increase the emphasis on the way that we manage environmental flows of water in the Murray-Darling Basin. So the basin
might,
is Australia's.
It might.
Yeah.
We've been down this track so often. Haven't we worked out what to do yet?
Well, we have done a lot. So the Murray-Darling Basin Plan has brought the basin states a long way from a system that was effectively unregulated, and it was take what you need, and the amount of water that was consumed wasn't properly capped or managed. Having the since 2012 the basin plan in place has meant that there have been significant recovery of water. And many people will say it's nowhere near enough and that we need to be much more ambitious about the water that's recovered in the basin and the way that we use that water for environmental management. And that's an argument that will go on, I'm sure, but it's not the case that we've done nothing. I think that we've taken a huge step over the last decade in understanding and managing and putting in place the framework for a more sustainable use of water in the Murray-Darling Basin.
Do you ever see the possibility of water rationing in this country? Rationing to homes, houses, you know?
To some degree, it happens because we have water restrictions. There is no...
Garden hoses.
Yeah. So we talk about some forms of water restrictions as being mandatory water restrictions. So that is effectively rationing in that we're saying that there are certain uses that you can't use water for during an extreme drought, during an emergency scenario.
From my earliest childhood, I remember those. The fury on Sydney's North Shore when you could no longer water your azaleas, Stuart, was terrible.
Indeed. And there are real social costs with water restrictions or water rationing as it really is. I mean, people's gardens, people's amenity is important. Gardens aren't just important to people. They're important to the birds and the insects, and the whole urban environment relies on properly watered greenery. Yeah. So there are big costs associated with water restrictions, and especially severe water restrictions like that. And then when they start to affect community assets, playing fields, we have been in situations where football ovals and cricket pitches have become unusable because they're too dry during a drought. So we do need to recognise that that's a real cost, and it is worth investing in higher levels of resilience in other water supplies that can be maintained through that drought, or in other ways of designing homes and gardens that will be more water efficient in themselves.
So is that what the politics of water boils down to in Australia at the moment? Sorry about boils down. That you either find the political courage to invest heavily now in the future, or you're going to be facing things like water restrictions.
We know that for sure. That's all of our cities have been through water restrictions. Even Darwin has had a couple of pretty harsh dry seasons where it's looked like water availability was going to become quite limited. Certainly Brisbane, Adelaide, Sydney, Perth have all been through yes. very serious water restrictions. So we do know that the supply side of water with our current systems is not guaranteed in all years. The way that we've set up water with a high reliance on rainfall does tend to mean that in wet years we get along just fine, and this is where the short memories come into play. But we are prone to drought, and those droughts come along periodically. We don't know how long a particular drought will last. But as we get deeper and deeper into drought, and we usually measure that in our cities by looking at our water storages in our dams, and as those water storages drop further and further, we impose more stringent restrictions on how people can use water.
How optimistic are you that Australia is going to be able to cope with its water needs in the future? We're booming in population, we're desperately trying to build new houses.
Yep.
Are we going to be able to feed them with water?
Yeah. So I think the coastal cities and the inland cities face different challenges, and or the inland towns and cities, inland communities, face different challenges, which will be addressed, need to be addressed in different ways. One thing that I usually say is that engineers can do anything. So if you're asking me in a technical sense, can we recycle all of our water? Can we supply all of our cities with desalinated seawater?
The answer, of course, is yes.
We can.
Yeah.
That's right. So it's not about the engineering capability to be able to do that. It's about the political will to prioritise, or political and community will, to prioritise water as a high priority, where we're investing in infrastructure ahead of the time that we most obviously need it, which is hard. You know, when dams are full, why should we expand the seawater desalination plant? Well, we need to do that because it takes 4 years to get a new desalination plant up and running. And in 4 years, you can be at the tail end of a pretty severe drought. So I think that it is a matter of us understanding the priority, and Australians are getting pretty good at that, especially in a drought. People do understand the value of water. People respond very well to water restrictions. We do understand that we're living in a dry country, in a country that's prone to drought. But maintaining that over the longer term is what's necessary. I think we will. It will just take a big enough crisis, and I think that's what we've seen already in Sydney. We've made big changes in Sydney after the Millennium Drought. That's when we started building desalination plants and things. And if you look at other places like Cape Town, for example, where they were counting down to day zero, they really thought they were going to run out of water, and they actually came very close to doing it. That spurred government investment and community support for government investment in major development of water supplies that are going on now, both seawater desalination and water recycling, to make that city more resilient. So my answer is yes, but we need a good fright to spur us on.
Stuart, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
I've been talking to Stuart Khan, Professor and Head of the School of Civil Engineering at the University of Sydney, about Australia and its water supply. This is Late Night Live.